Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson. And the crucial midterm elections are only about 7 weeks away, and it's a good time to take stock of the battle for the U.S. Senate, the U.S. House, and state houses across the country. It's also a critical time to take stock of local races on both sides of the river in Illinois and Iowa. And to do that with me today, I'm very pleased to have on for the first time, Jacob Rubashkin, who's a reporter and analyst for Inside Elections. Inside Elections, for those of you who may not know, provides nonpartisan analysis for Senate, House, governor, and presidential campaigns. Jacob previously worked for NBC News and CNN, and I'm very, very pleased that you took time out of a very busy time to be with us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, kind of give us generally an overview of what's at stake for our listeners, just on the House and Senate and governorships, if you would.
So control of Congress is on the line. That's been pretty obvious since the results of the 2020 elections, when Democrats came into Washington with exceedingly narrow majorities in both the House and the Senate. Republicans need just one seat to flip the United States Senate. That would allow them to block not just legislation, but any sort of nominees that President Joe Biden wants to put up. That would give Mitch McConnell effectively veto power over Biden's nominees. Republicans need just five seats to take back the House of Representatives. And historically speaking, midterm elections are bad for the party in power. That's a very narrow margin for Democrats to be clinging to. And so control of the Senate on the line, control of the House on the line, the fate of the second half of Joe Biden's presidency really hangs in the balance depending on the results of these midterms.
You mentioned kind of the historical trends where the party that controls the White House struggles in these off-year elections. It must be just an immediate reaction of the public to slow down or ensure divided government, or that our government moves slowly. But this year is a somewhat unique year, and every 10 years, as listeners know, we do reapportionment. Census comes out, district lines are drawn differently. How did that end up as far as affecting the balance of power heading into these elections? Did either party gain more to put them in a better spot heading into this cycle?
The thing to remember about gerrymandering and redistricting as we look at the results of those 50 individual processes that played out on their own timelines across all 50 states is that we're not starting from a neutral place. You have to remember 10 years ago, when Republicans came into power all across the country in the 2010 midterms, they enacted sweeping gerrymanders across quite a few states that helped them win back the majority maintain the majority that they had won back in 2010 for most of the following decade. So the maps that we had been using for the past decade had been very favorable to Republican candidates. The maps that we have after this redistricting cycle are less favorable to Republican candidates, but still on balance are more favorable to Republicans than if we had a purely proportional system of representation in government. Republicans also caught quite a few breaks in the redistricting process over the last year. The most strict Republican gerrymanders in states like Florida and Texas, for instance, Ohio as well, faced significant legal challenges that were ultimately beat back. And those maps were implemented, locking in a significant Republican majority in each of those states' congressional delegations, whereas Democrats really struggled to get any of their more aggressive maps through the litigation process in states like New York and Maryland, where Democrats had complete control of the map-making process. They passed maps that would have been very helpful in, politically speaking, to keep the House majority, and the courts, either at the state or federal level, struck those down. So Democrats had quite a few legal losses. Republicans had quite a few legal wins that resulted in a favorable map to Republicans, but less favorable than the status quo from 2010.
And if our listeners are interested, we're in a great laboratory here where we border Iowa and Illinois, where Iowa is a prototypical state that has an independent commission draw the district lines. And if you look at Illinois, the majority party drew them, the Democrats, and you can see some very interesting configurations. The district I live in, for example, and in the one that runs from the Metro East area up in the Springfield, drawn very creatively to ensure Democratic power. So it's an interesting process.
Yeah, I mean, I think Iowa is perhaps the rock in a raging sea of redistricting. Every decade, the districts are drawn by the Nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency, and they always manage to draw quite a few highly competitive races. Iowa is consistently home to some of the most competitive House races in the country because their districts are drawn so evenly. And of course, it helps that the state is a rectangle that population-wise can be divided pretty much right down the middle in either direction, and you get four perfect quadrants. So they do have some natural advantages, but they are really an outlier, I would say, in the redistricting process, in how straightforward and simple and competitive their races always end up being.
Well, it's one of the things I love about following politics is just when you think you got it figured out, everything changes. And it's been that way over the last 5-6 years, even more than normal in my lifetime anyway. But it seems like, what, about 2 months ago, 3 months ago, it looked like the major issues in the fall campaign were going to be inflation and crime, which I think most observers felt played to the Republican strength. That's changed a lot. How do you see these issues playing out right now? I know we're 7 weeks away, but it seems like some issues have come to the fore that look like they might help Democrats a little bit.
That's exactly right. And it really comes down to the Supreme Court's decision in the Dobbs case, overturning Roe versus Wade, overturning 50 years of precedent, and effectively making abortion illegal in quite a few states automatically. And as we see Republican legislators move to restrict abortion access in other states where they have control, quite a few states in the near future. That is a change to the status quo in a way that's really rare these days in politics, at a time when legislating at a national level is sparse, to say the least. The change in law across the country brought about by that decision and the immediate effect it had on people's lives is something that truly could have and most likely will have an impact on these midterms. That really does seem to be the turning point in a lot of ways for Democrats as they faced a mind-numbingly challenging environment at the beginning of the summer to now, where they still face an uphill battle but feel slightly better. You know, there are other things that have happened along the way. Inflation has cooled off a bit. Gas prices have come down from their peak. You know, Joe Biden's student loan initiative has perhaps let him claw back some ground among younger voters who had previously been pretty lukewarm on him. You know, things have passed Congress, the Veterans Burn Pits Act, the Inflation Reduction Act, the Bipartisan Infrastructure Bill. But I would say all of those are secondary in terms of their effect on the fundamentals of the midterms to the Dobbs decision and how that has reshaped the landscape.
Are there examples in elections so far that occurred after Dobbs that I know Kansas had a statewide referendum? Are there any other elections that you can share that you think might have impact on our competitive, especially the competitive House races on both sides of the border here?
In addition to that Kansas referendum, which was on a specific ballot measure where voters really could isolate the particular issue of abortion access, and we saw a pretty stunning majority of Kansan voters, close to 60%, reject an effort to remove the right to an abortion from the Kansas Constitution. We saw in some other special elections that have taken place since then signs of a more favorable national environment for Democrats. So there was a special election in Nebraska's first district, which is kind of the outside of Omaha, includes Lincoln. And this is a heavily Republican district voted for Donald Trump by double digits. The Democrat came within 6 points of winning that race. That was shortly after the Dobbs decision broke. In upstate New York, there were two congressional special elections, one in a very Republican district and one in a pretty prototypical swing district. And the Democrat came fairly close in the very Republican district, did not win, but only lost by about 4 points. And in the swing district, the Democrat, Pat Ryan, actually won, which was a somewhat unexpected outcome, beat a very well-regarded Republican recruit by 3 points to hold that seat for Democrats. And so we have seen evidence in those special elections. You can also include Alaska in there as well. It's a little bit different because of the way that they conduct their elections. But the Democratic candidate, now the Congresswoman from Alaska, Mary Peltola, made abortion rights one of the centerpieces of her campaign. Even in a Republican state like Alaska, it was clearly effective.
How are the candidates approaching Biden and Trump? They seem to be hovering over this election cycle. Biden's numbers were down. They seem to be coming back. Trump is either you love him or you hate him, it seems like. Are certain candidates bringing these gentlemen into their districts, or what type of candidates are bringing them in, I guess, is the question. Are some of them in the real close battleground districts willing to take that chance yet?
It seems like candidates in the closest races are really trying to avoid bringing in either Biden or Trump for themselves, for their respective efforts. If anything, what we see is Republicans really trying to introduce Biden as an issue in quite a few places, not just Republican areas, but in moderately Democratic areas as well, places where the president may have won in 2020, but he's now relatively unpopular. Republicans are really trying to tie Democratic incumbents and Democratic challengers to Joe Biden and the policies of the Biden administration, whereas it is more rare to see a Democrat welcome Biden with open arms in any sort of constituency that didn't vote for him by, 15 points or more. Biden's first true campaign rally was a couple weeks ago, and he went to Maryland. He stumped for Maryland gubernatorial candidate Wes Moore. Of course, Maryland's a state that Biden won 2-1. And so that's a pretty easy landing spot for the president on the campaign trail. But you'd be hard pressed to find a Democrat running in a toss-up district who would enthusiastically bring Biden into campaign. They'll probably say nice things about him if you prodded them on it. But in general, I think Democrats are trying to run their own races and Republicans are trying to bring in Biden. I think when it comes to Trump, nobody really seems to know what to do with him at the moment. I think part of that is because nobody ever has known what to do with him. And Democrats are still feeling a little bit burned by the 2021 Virginia gubernatorial race, where Terry McAuliffe made Trump a centerpiece in his strategy against Republican Glenn Youngkin, called him Glenn Trumpkin, tried very, very hard to link Youngkin to Trump at every possible opportunity, did not win that race. And so I think Democrats, by and large, are trying to focus more on the specific policy issues, be that abortion, be that January 6, be that positive things like the Infrastructure Act and the student loan debt forgiveness, rather than trying to tie their opponents back to Donald Trump. I think that could change if Trump announces his bid for 2024 before the midterms. It could also change if Trump is indicted before the midterms. Again, there's a level of uncertainty that surrounds that man that makes all of our jobs more difficult. But at the moment, he is an unseen factor in these races rather than a seen and discussed factor.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Quad City NPR. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is Jacob Rubashkin, who's a reporter and analyst for Inside Elections. If you haven't checked this out, you should. It's easy enough to find, insideelections.com. They provide ratings on House, Senate, gubernatorial races and provide some expert analysis. Jacob posts regularly, and I enjoy reading his stuff. And it's important, I guess, to get, again, this is a nonpartisan analysis. So they take a straight approach, which is hard to find these days. So I urge our listeners to check it out and follow Inside Elections and Jacob in particular. Let's get into it here. What are you seeing right now? Again, we're about 7 weeks out, but what are you seeing? Let's go right into the U.S. House of Representatives. Does either side have an advantage here?
Republicans are still in the driver's seat when it comes to the House of Representatives. Remember, they need to flip just five seats in order to take back control of the chamber. Historically speaking, the party out of power in a midterm over the last 100 years has won an average of 29 seats in a midterm election. And so from that perspective, they have quite a bit of room to spare in their quest to retake the majority. I think if you look at a district by district analysis of every single race in the country, which is what we do at Inside Elections, the picture is slightly less rosy for Republicans. Our current projection is a Republican net gain of between 12 to 30 seats. At the moment, I would say something on the lower end seems more likely than something on the higher end of that range, though anything within that range would be expected. And the reason for that is there are simply not enough opportunities for Democrats to go on offense. And there are so many opportunities for Republicans to go on offense that that imbalance puts Democrats in a really tough spot, that we have not seen yet Democrats really move aggressively against any open any Republican incumbents beyond a select few, or any open Republican seats beyond a select few. And if this were truly shaping up to be an election in which both parties had equal chances or near equal chances of winning a majority, we would see more balance there. We would see a wide set of Republican held seats that were highly competitive and a wide set of Democratic held seats that were highly competitive. And at the moment, we see a wide set of Democratic held seats that are very competitive and only a small subset of Republican seats. So until that changes, we're gonna see Republicans as the favorites to take back the House.
Let's look at some of the key races here in our region. If folks have been watching TV, they've seen the ads already here for quite a few weeks. We've got three right in the Quad City region that are critical and are being hard fought and contested. Let's start on the Iowa side. We've got the incumbent Ashley Hinson facing Liz Matthes up in Iowa 1. How do you think that's shaping up? And again, for our listeners, you've heard me say many times on this show and many of our guests, it's tough to be an incumbent. But it can happen, and in this cycle, it's certainly a lot of these races are going to be pretty close. But how are you looking at that one right now?
We currently have this race rated as lean Republican, so we see Ashley Hinson as a pretty clear favorite. But it's not out of the question that Liz Matthes, the Democrat, could pull off an upset. Ashley Hinson is a freshman congresswoman. She is a strong fundraiser. She beat a candidate that an incumbent that Democrats thought very highly of in 2020, Abby Finkenauer. She's established herself in the state, is very much considered a rising star in the party. Liz Matthes brings a lot to the table, though. She has a similar background coming out of the news business. The two of them actually worked at the same television station for a little bit in the 2000s. Career as a state legislator, also a very strong fundraiser. And the reason at the end of the day that we see this district and the one we're about to talk about as competitive is what we were talking about earlier, which is the Iowa maps being so evenly divided, that these districts are very intrinsically competitive. Donald Trump only won each of them by fairly narrow margins. And so the floor for Democrats is high. And with a good candidate like Liz Matthes, they should be able to take advantage of that high floor and make this race competitive. It is hard to beat an incumbent. It obviously happened in 2020 for Ashley Hinson. And this still looks like a better year for Republicans than 2020 was, which is why we see Hinson as the favorite. But in close districts such as this one, in districts that are comfortable voting for Democrats, And this district has shown that in the past it has voted for Democrats. A good Democratic candidate is going to be competitive.
In the Iowa 2nd District, incumbent Marionette Miller Meeks is running, and this district, of course, includes the Iowa side of the Quad Cities. She's got an interesting race also against Christina Bohannon, who's running against her on the Democratic side. How are you seeing that one?
So this one looks very similar to the Hinson-Mathis race in that the two districts are very similarly composed in terms of partisanship. The wrinkle here, of course, is that Marionette Miller Meeks won the closest race of the entire 2020 cycle, beat Democratic nominee Rita Hart by just 6 votes. I think it's pretty clear at this point that if Dave Loebsack, the incumbent Democrat from last cycle, had run again, he would have won, as he had defeated Miller Meeks, I believe, three times previously. This was her fourth bid for office. And so, again, this is a district that has voted for Democrats in the past fairly consistently since, you know, Jim Leach lost a decade and a half ago. And Christina Bohannon, decent candidate, has a base of support coming out of the state legislature, also raising money. Evenly divided district should be competitive. Iowa has certainly moved in Republicans' direction over the last decade, and that's why we don't see this race or the Hinson race as a pure toss-up. But there's reason to believe that Democrats can still have a fighting chance in these areas, at least this cycle.
On the Illinois side of the river, we have an open seat. Congresswoman Sherry Bustos chose not to run again, and her opponent from 2020, Esther Joy King, on the Republican side is running again against Eric Sorensen, a first-time candidate who people know more as a weatherman, a TV weatherman in the Rockford and Quad City markets. How's that one looking?
This one is another example of the struggles that Democrats have this cycle. This is a place where Democrats went out of their way to give themselves an advantage in the redistricting process. Illinois is controlled at all levels by the Democratic Party in terms of drawing the new maps. They redrew this district to excise much of the more Republican rural areas, really narrow it down to just the Democratic areas of the, you know, this northwest corner of the state, added in Bloomington, made this district significantly more Democratic. But with Congresswoman Bustos' decision not to run for re-election, it's an open seat. Republicans had a candidate ready to go in Esther Joy King. She had run in 2020, had exceeded expectations, very nearly beat Congresswoman Bustos in a race that nobody really thought was competitive until the final 2 or 3 weeks. And she was ready to jump in as soon as Congresswoman Bustos announced she wasn't running. She has been a very good candidate for Republicans in that she is raising a lot of money. She has a compelling personal story. She's already up on TV, and she has avoided the missteps of a first-time candidate, especially, I think, about what we're seeing in Republicans in the United States Senate, where they have quite a few first-time candidates really struggling to get their sea legs. Having already had a competitive election under her belt, Esther Joy King was ready from day one. Eric Sorensen is a political newcomer. He has the built-in cachet of being a longtime TV weatherman, which matters. We just spent a couple minutes talking about Liz Mathis and Ashley Hinson, who both had careers on TV news. It's not uncommon for TV news people to be very successful in politics, but he is a first-time candidate. He has not raised as much money as I think a lot of Democrats would have hoped. And so this is a race that we have actually seen getting better for Republicans. It kind of cuts against the grain of perhaps what we've seen in the national landscape, as a lot of races that once looked shaky for Democrats have gotten a little bit better for them. This is a race where, based on the candidate quality, we are seeing Republicans enter the stretch with a little bit more momentum. And it's incumbent on Democrats and Sorensen and his allies to right the ship before Election Day.
What's your rating right now?
We currently have it as a toss-up.
toss-up.
A pure toss-up, but we had it in the Democratic column. We moved it into toss-up. The way we think about the race right now is it starts out as a tied race, and that points to being a toss-up. However, Esther Joy King has about $3 million more dollars than Eric Sorensen does in the bank, and in a district like this one, which has relatively inexpensive media markets, that goes a long way. She's been able to be up on TV. Sorensen will not be able to match her. He's going to have to rely on outside groups to come in and spend on his behalf. And at the moment, it's unclear just how much support he's going to get from them, especially if he's not able to chip in a little bit more of his own campaign funds. And so when a contest begins tied, and you're staring at a financial disadvantage in the most important part of the election where voters are finally paying attention, it doesn't look great. It doesn't look great for your prospects to be the one who comes out on top. It still could happen. You know, this is a Democratic district after redistricting, but Esther Joy King has a lot of advantages heading in to the final weeks that Sorensen doesn't.
We're down to just a couple minutes left. We took quite a bit of time in the House, and that's okay. I know if folks want to check out the ratings on the Senate races nationwide, if you could kind of rapid fire here, kind of give a guess on where the Senate's going to wind up. And then in particular, there's incumbents running in both states, Tammy Duckworth, Illinois, Chuck Grassley in Iowa. Are those pretty solid for the incumbents, or are there any chances for the challengers?
In terms of the big picture, we see the Senate as a pure toss-up at this point. Our projected outcome is anywhere from a Republican net gain of one seat to a Democratic net gain of one seat, and that includes a push with both parties remaining at 50-50, which of course would leave Democrats in the majority. When it comes to Illinois, this is a seat we have rated as solid Democratic. Tammy Duckworth looks to be in very strong position. Republicans got the best candidate that they could have gotten out of the field of C-tier candidates that ran in that race in Kathy Salvey. The Salvey name is known. Obviously, her husband having run several statewide campaigns before, and some of the other characters in that Republican primary truly had no shot winning statewide. But Illinois is a very Democratic state, and this is not a race that Republicans are talking about seriously in D.C. as being competitive. In Iowa, that's also a race we have rated as solid for the incumbent, Chuck Grassley. I do think, though, this race is going to surprise people because there are two things happening here that can both exist at the same time, but oftentimes people think that they're mutually exclusive, which is that Chuck Grassley is clearly favored to win and probably will win, but he's also in the toughest race that he's had since he first ran for the United States Senate in 1980. And so we're going to see a lot of numbers out of this state over the next couple weeks that make this look like a closer race than Grassley has ever run in before. He's never lost by more than 20 points as an incumbent. And I think he will, or at least he's never won by fewer than 20 points, excuse me, as an incumbent. I think that Mike Franken has a compelling background. He is raising good money. He's got an interesting digital strategy. He is running a very, a real race in a way that Grassley has not faced before. Does it mean Grassley's going to lose? No. Iowa is a Republican state and they like him. But I think this is going to be a closer outcome than anything we've seen from Chuck Grassley in the better part of 40 years.
Okay. This is doing the impossible in about 30 seconds. The two governor's races with Democratic incumbent in Illinois, Republican incumbent in Iowa. Any shot for the challengers at all?
Probably not. J.B. Pritzker has unlimited money. They got the candidate they wanted in Darren Bailey. We don't see this race as particularly competitive. Again, no Democrat has won an Illinois governor's race with more than 54% of the vote in a very long time. So would it be a surprise to see this race as a single digit race? No, I think that that would not be unexpected, but to see Bailey win would be truly unexpected. We've got the inverse situation in Iowa. Deidre DeGeer, the Democratic nominee there, has really, really struggled to raise any sort of money. Kim Reynolds, the incumbent, has good fundraising. Iowa is a Republican state. It's going to be difficult, especially with a competitive Senate race and three competitive House races, all taking up airtime for DeGeer to get herself in front of enough voters to make that race competitive.
All right. Well, thank you for kind of going through quickly some of those races at the end. Jacob Rabashkin's been my guest today on Heartland Politics. Jacob's a reporter and analyst for Inside Elections. You can follow him at insideelections.com. You can also follow him on Twitter. I suggest you doing that. Again, Inside Elections is a nonpartisan analysis they provide for Senate, House, governor, and presidential campaigns. So it's a welcome kind of nonpartisan look where you can get away from each side's spin on these issues. Jacob, thank you so much for coming on. I look forward to having you back sometime.
Happy to do it.
Hang on.